Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
I just love that music. I just absolutely love that music.
I love that we're starting the show with a little musical interlude.
We do. Very nice. I'm trying to mix it up a little bit and find different music for different authors.
Like that.
And you know, it's been fun. Finding this.
I mean,
what did we do for Heisner? We had Silverado.
So cool.
I see. Match the music to the guest. Hey, this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina. And sitting across from me in the studio, of course, is the lovely and charming Bobby Jean Bell. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to cut down my adjectives because I was running out.
Wait, you're a writer.
I know. I'm almost out of words. We've cut them down to lovely and charming. And her husband, Jim, of course, is here, and he just sits over there, and he nods, and he chuckles, and he just
waves. He smiles, and he loves to hear about the books.
He enjoys the show.
I read aloud to him in the car sometimes. I go, you have to read that. You have to hear this.
You do. It's pretty cool. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was very nice. How about you?
It was very, very nice. The kids were over, and did I tell you about my granddaughter?
No.
Oh, my God. Her name is Emma June.
Oh, yes.
She's learning how to say Emma June. So now it is coming out, I'm a Jew. She's not, but she doesn't know.
Out of the mouths of babes.
So, Rochelle, if you're listening, it's not true.
That's adorable.
Oh, she's going to be two.
And she's got you wrapped around her finger.
She's got everybody wrapped around.
Yes.
Jerry calls her the boss. She's going to be two next month on the 20th.
Two going on 20.
Oh, I know. It's just like she's all over the place. And she finally got to meet Bella the dog.
Oh.
So she got to hang out with Bella. And of course, every time, you know, Bella would go and lick her face, and she'd scream and run back to her daddy and then run back over and get some more. You know, it's just what she does.
So you should be writing a kid's book.
I know. I'd leave that for Jerry.
Well, yes. But you two should collaborate on a kid's story.
Right. Well, yeah, I could.
You know,
I could probably read a short one.
Her as inspiration.
Yeah. Well, I know we've got a couple copies of the Jerry's, the one that she wrote, the Scarecrow.
Yeah,
and
Scarecrow.
And the Pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to her when she can get old enough to read it, or Daddy can read it to her. Okay. The Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing and by Tuscany Bay Books. And if you're a writer, or you think you're a writer, and you've written something you don't quite know what to do with, or if you're a screenwriter or a playwright or a poet, Tuscany Bay is where you want to come. We do just about everything for the beginning writers. We edit and we proofread, and if you don't want to use our editing, you're more than free to use whatever editor you want to use. We have one that we use on a cut rate basis, and she does a terrific job. Or you use your own editor, whichever you want. The costs are minimal, and the products come out very nice. So that's Tuscany Bay Books, and that number there is 805-795-3165. And Out West, which is your online source for... I'm trying to get my paperwork out here, and I'm just having a hell of a time. Online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and the Western lifestyles. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, boots, hats, fashion accessories, home decor, books, music, and general merchandise. You're going to have to rewrite this now.
I know. And it's all delivered by the Jingle Bells.
That's right. National brands include Scully Leather, Rockmount Ranchwear, Dan Post Boots, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. Their toll-free number is 1-877-340-9378. And if you do online, their email or their online address is www.scvoutwest.com. And if you enter code WB100, you can receive $10 off of your first order. So there you have it.
And we have had some shoppers that have been using that code. Thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. And we just we'll continue this. And you're doing well with it. Also, since 2009, Target Freight has had a full truckload service, TFM truckload. That is the best in the industry. Not only are they exceptionally good at what they do, but they strive to make your full truckload shipping experience unparalleled. Call TFM Truckload today at 844-653-7789. Ask for Mike Matruski or any of the fine Target TFM staff. Tell them you heard it here on the Writer's Block, and TFM will have a little something extra for you. And if you are an LTL shipper, getting your freight moved your way, the most expedient way possible, is what you need. One-stop shop, no hassle. Call Target Freight Management today. Their customized traffic movement program is the finest in the industry, bar none. So call at 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web for both truckload and LTL. Call today, and you will not be disappointed. And that's no kidding. You will not be disappointed. They're just really, really great folks. Okay, let's get into tonight's guest. This guy is like, wow.
Amazing.
This guy is just totally amazing.
I'm speechless.
I am. I read this book, and as I told him on the phone the other night when I called him on our pre-interview, I said, this is the only book I've ever read where I felt really stupid.
Oh.
I'm telling you, this book is so cerebral. And you know, I know Rob's going to go, oh, wow.
But entertaining at the same time.
It is entertaining, and you know, the storyline just rolls. It just really, truly does. It's just trying to dig your way through it that it kind of gets a little tough. But I managed, and I finished all 411 pages. Yay me! And I will have to tell you that our author tonight also last year wrote himself a book called "Donald Trump is President." How the hell did that happen? We're going to be talking about that because they're selling that actually nationwide now. So that's getting to be pretty cool. Robert is a science fiction writer and a futurist. He's been interviewed over 350 times on radio, over 350 times on television, and countless times in print. He lives in Mississauga, Ontario, Canada, just outside of Toronto. Rob is only one of eight writers in history and the only Canadian to win all three of the world's top science fiction awards for best novel of the year, the Hugo, the Nebula, and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award. The book we're going to be talking about this evening, and I'm sure, and then, of course, his Donald Trump book, because I got to find out about that, is called Quantum Night, and it's about psychopaths.
And a whole lot more.
And generally we go into that night. And well, let's let Robert tell you about it, his own little story here. Can we bring Robert in? Robert, are you with us?
I am here. I have to correct you. I do not have a book about Donald Trump. Oh. The title you referred to is a blog post of mine.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
But in a sense, of course, Quantum Night turned out to be a book.
About Donald Trump.
Yes. My reading of how history has turned out there. It's a book about the possibility that somebody who might not have much in the way of empathy might end up being the most powerful person on the planet.
And, there you go.
I know there's a spectrum of political opinion. Actually, there isn't much in the United States. There's a polarization opinion in the United States.
Yes,
there people is. On the left and people on the right, there's not a whole lot in the middle anymore
and
in your country.
Stand up, sit down,
it's
fight,
my country,
fight.
Too, I have to say. I'm a dual citizen, American citizen.
Oh, are you really?
Oh, are you? Are you?
So, yeah, absolutely. So I take, considerable interest in what's happening to one of my great country.
Well, and then be fortunate that you're sitting up there in Canada, eh?
I count my blessings, sir, in my best secular humanist way every day.
That's pretty bad when your prime minister leaves and goes back to Canada and just goes, holy crap.
it's interesting because I love Justin Trudeau, who is our prime minister
right.
in Canada, but I have never been fond of political dynasties. if there was one reason that I, you know, was uncomfortable with Hillary Clinton, it was that there'd already been a Clinton in the White House.
Sure.
There's a reason that I was uncomfortable with George W. Bush, as we'd already had George H.W., right? The Kennedys, of course, are a dynasty of the United States. And America worked very hard to throw off a monarchy, throw off royal families. Mm-hmm. And Canada ultimately did in all but symbolism in its own way. And I'm not a fond of political dynasties at all. But I got to say, man, if you're going to have a political dynasty, let it be the Trudeaus.
Well, yeah, because his father was prime minister, Pierre, right?
Yeah.
His father was Pierre, right. Absolutely.
And Pierre had a hot wife.
Whenever you look at history, people have different opinions. And you look back decades later, and of course you can't look at it with the eyes of the 60s and 70s. You've got to look at it with the eyes of today. That's the eyes you have right now. So everybody has, you know, there are people, including my own brother, who can't stand the legacy of Pierre Trudeau. Uh-huh. And then people like myself who greatly admire him. And then the same thing will be true for almost any president down the road, of course. Sure. The history will give us that 2020 hindsight.
Sure, that's what we do here. I mean, you know, we vilify everybody until they're gone, and then they were the best we ever had.
So we're talking, because I'm not sure we gave your whole name. We call you Rob, but your official, if you're searching for books by you, is Robert J. Sawyer. And we're talking tonight, already jumping into the book Quantum Night.
Right.
And one of the characters is a U.S. president by the name of Quentin Caraway. So when you created Quentin, were you already kind of had in mind that a Donald Trump kind of character would be our president, or is it just
a Donald Trump kind of character? That's right, Bobby. The thing is about traditional publishing, of course, the book is just out now in paperback. Mm-hmm. It was out in hardcover a year ago, which meant I finished it about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, Donald Trump wasn't even in the running to be one of, you know, there was this field of Republican candidates, and he hadn't yet come in. And then right up, I remember vividly, as we all do, wherever you are in the political spectrum, up until the day before he became the official Republican candidate, people, there's no way it's going to be Trump. And then people right on the day before the election, November of last year, there's no way it's going to be Trump. Well, it turned out to be Trump. So I'm a good prognosticator, but I am not clairvoyant.
Don't let us thank you.
I knew that the trend was towards somebody catering more and more successively, the Republican Party catering more and more to the far right of its base. And that's not just Republicans in the United States, by the way.
Gotcha.
That's conservative parties all over the Western world.
Right.
They're catering to the farther and farther right, while the left is often very fragmented and not effective opposition. So I knew that somebody, as you said, a Trump-like character was waiting in the wings. Right. But if I'd known in advance, I would have given him the right name in the novel. Believe me, Donald J. Trump.
Well, here, let me give the phone number out in case there's anybody who wants to challenge you on this book. You know, like I said, I felt stupid. The number here in the studio is 818.
Stupid, my
friend. I know. 818-602-4929. Again, that number here in the studio, and you can call in and talk to Rob yourself, and then Bobby and I can go get coffee. The number here again is 818-602-4929. So let's talk about Quantum Night. I read it. I did. And as I told you the other day, I was almost finished with it. Bobby finished with it, I think, on Sunday or Saturday.
Yeah.
That was when I got the phone call from her saying, how much of this book did you understand? And none.
Well, you had read about 120 pages.
I know.
And I said, well, wait till you get to the Q1, Q2, Q3, and then it all kind of make sense. And, of course, that doesn't happen until around page 319 or so. But
not giving away any spoiler alerts. This book is primarily written about finding out or discerning psychopaths.
It's so much.
That's right.
It's so complex.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the main character is a social scientist at the University of Manitoba, Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, who part of his job is he's appears as expert witness in trials. The only time anybody ever gets technically diagnosed as a psychopath is if it's part of a legal defense one way or another, or legal prosecution. And so he's one of the guys who goes around and provides testimony when somebody is being held up as potentially being a psychopath. I say that because, you know, in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which is the standard Bible of diagnosing mental illnesses, there actually isn't one called psychopath or psychopathy. Right. But it's a term we all understand. Somebody who is completely self-centered, has no empathy for other people, and will simply lie and be sexually promiscuous and deceitful in any number of ways, using people because he literally, or she, less often, but she too, simply doesn't see that other person as a human being. They're just a means to an end. We know what this term means, psychopath.
Sure.
And anyway, so the novel is about a guy. This is, it's a science fiction novel set in the present day. So it's not Star Wars. It's not laser beams or blasters or lightsabers. But it's set in the present day. But the science fictional conceit is an invention of an infallible way to identify psychopaths. The current way of doing it in real life is a checklist that has 20 items on it, and an expert examiner will score you on these 20 points. I mentioned some of them already. Risk-taking, being an inveterate liar, sexual promiscuity, as I said. That's entirely... It's as good as we've got currently, but it's flawed because it depends on how skillful the assessor is at making a judgment. You know, if I knew you better than I did, Bobby, would I say Bobby lies never at all? Bobby lies sometimes about her private life, but never about her professional life. Bobby lies all the time. Those are those three choices that would be on the survey. Well, I might misjudge you and give you the wrong score. Maybe everything you say is absolutely true, but I just don't buy it, right?
Sure.
And I give you the wrong score. So it's prone to error. And so the science fictional conceit is a technique that makes it infallible for detecting psychopaths. And then lo and behold, as the plot progresses, our hero, the social scientist named Jim, discovers that the president of the United States is a bona fide psychopath.
Right.
And lo and behold, mayhem ensues.
Yeah, and he discovers a black hole in his own history,
right,
which was, it made the hair go up on my arms.
While he was testifying in court.
Yeah, and he had, you know, again, we don't want to do spoiler alerts, but you take us on such a roller coaster ride of, okay, now I'm getting some science, now I'm getting something political, ooh, now I'm combining science and politics and morality and faith and all kinds of things, all sort of mishmashed,
right,
you know?
Right.
And,
well, I like to think of mishmash would not be the technical term I would use for the finely wrought tapestry of narrative threads.
What about if you capitalize the M's? Would that make it okay?
That's right, yes. But you're right. I mean, when most people who don't read science fiction think of science fiction, they do think of Star Wars, just mindless action.
Oh, sure, and Star Trek.
But
sure,
if you've read science fiction, going right back to the first science fiction novel, which is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, or the work of H.G. Wells. Remember, H.G. Wells was a social scientist. He was a historian by profession. And, you know, The War of the Worlds, for instance, everybody knows that because there have been so many movie versions. But when Wells wrote the book for his contemporaries, that book came out in 1902 in Great Britain. I think it was, around then, anyways. Maybe that was the first American edition, I think 1896 in the UK. In any event, he wasn't writing about Martians invading Earth. He was writing about the British Empire invading all these places all over the world, as they did, and trying to show to Brits what it would be like if the shoe was on the other foot. He was making a political statement. We would hate for this to happen to us. which is why the Martians invade. Although, of course, the War of the Worlds, we never see them anywhere but Great Britain in the novel. It's why they invade Britain, is because he was trying to send a political message. Mm-hmm. So print science fiction, ambitious print science fiction, has always been about this. And the good TV shows, Star Trek, The Twilight Zone, the original series, mm-hmm. were very often about political metaphors.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Right.
You know, so that's what I tried to do.
Now, our main character, Jim, you know, we really get to know him because he's sort of discovering himself
right.
along the way.
Rediscovering himself. Yeah.
Now, he follows utilitarian thinking, and that was interesting to me. Tell us a little bit about utilitarian thinking.
Utilitarianism has the worst name possible for a really loving kind of philosophy. Mm-hmm. It is simply the philosophy that the greatest good is the maximizing of happiness for the largest number of people. And it has one thing that really is, a virtue that a number of religions in theory share, which is, and in maximizing that happiness, you can't put a special value on your own happiness. What did Jesus say? If somebody, asks for your coat, you give them your pants. That would be quite.
Yeah.
Not a
did he ever say that?
Quite the right metaphor, but it was words to that effect, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody asks you to go, I'm gonna give them an extra mile. Go the extra mile. Do whatever you can to help somebody else. And so utilitarianism says, if something's gonna make me unhappy 10%. Yeah, I was feeling good today. I'm 10% less happy. And it's going to make you, Jim, 10% happier. Well, then it's a trade-off. It's a wash. But if it also will make you, Bobby, 10% happier, then the math is obvious. I got to take the hit because I'm only losing 10%. But out of our community of the three of us, you guys are getting in total an aggregate of 20%
right. mm-hmm.
more happiness, 10 each. So it's a really interesting principle. And it's been around for a long time. Economic professors teach it all the time. My parents were economists by profession. But I think it really has a lot of utility. Just ask yourself, okay, don't look out for number one. Look out for the overall community I'm part of and see what I can do to maximize the happiness of people around me. And if my happiness goes up too, well, so much the better, right? But I can't say that that's the goal. That's the difference between a psychopath and a utilitarian. A psychopath says the only number that counts is my ever-increasing
right,
happiness
right.
or stature or power or however, whatever metric. Whereas the utilitarian says the only metric that counts is the ever-increasing happiness of the population. And Jim Marchuk is his last
right.
name, he's Ukrainian. My professor is a utilitarian philosopher as a teacher of philosophy at the university, but also really tries to not just talk the talk in the classroom, but walk the walk
yeah,
in
he
his
does.
Personal life.
Right, right.
Yes, and he does discover some things about himself. He has this 6-month period or so, 2001, that was interesting that you would choose 2001 to be where he has kind of a black hole.
That's right. When he was an undergraduate,
right.
He 6 months of his life have been wiped out. And, you know, every novel I write has a theme. And the theme for this book is the most pernicious, the most evil lie humanity has ever told itself is that you cannot change human nature. Because that's a crutch that says, okay, we're always going to be this way. You know what's happening with Harvey Weinstein and Al Franken and
sure.
Garrison Keillor and everybody who's fallen in the last month. And what are you going to do? That's boys will be boys. You can't change human nature. Well, in fact, what I believe very strongly is that you can change human nature. Now,
mm-hmm.
Jim is this wonderful utilitarian. He'll give the shirt off his back to help another person in the present day. But to really make literal this notion that you can change human nature, I have him discover that there was a time when he was not like that
mm-hmm.
at all, when he was,
mm-hmm.
in fact, the exact opposite. Look out for number one guy, a psychopath, and even a time where he really wasn't there at all, just a completely non-conscious entity.
Right.
So that's the beauty of science fiction is it lets you do these experiments, thought experiments about the human condition that you just can't conduct in real life. either because they're impossible or because they would be radically unethical to conduct in real life.
I find it amazing that I've just read 411 pages on psychopathy and just realized within the last 5 minutes what a psychopath really was. I mean, I always had a vision in my mind, and I always had a thought, but I never really understood the derision of a psychopath versus, okay, for lack of a better term, a Q3.
Right. Well.
Right. And Q1, Q2, Q3 are the successively more elaborate states of consciousness that I postulate in the novel Quantum Night, my latest book.
Right.
So Q1 is essentially completely unaware, just the mindless member of the mob. Q2 only has thoughts for himself or herself, and Q3 is thinking about, has an inner voice, which a psychopath does not. A psychopath never says, you know, buddy, you shouldn't ought to do that.
Yeah,
whereas you and I,
they hear
every
those
day,
inner voices.
Think, from everything from should I take that extra donut to, hey, I just found a wallet with $50 in it. Do I just pocket the 50 or do I return the guy's wallet? Right? Mm-hmm. What do you do? There's that little voice that says, now, rob. You know what you should do, right? Conscience, we call it. Not consciousness, but conscience.
Conscience,
two very distinct things. And our general, we see psychopaths in pop culture where they're always serial killers. Dexter in the TV series Dexter, Hannibal Lecter in all of the iterations of that story, including, of course, Silence of the Lambs. That's one kind of way psychopaths manifest their power. They simply don't see other people as other people. They're a means to an end. But they can also, in fact, there's some valuable psychopaths in society. It's been said by the people who devised that psychopathic trait checklist, Robert Hare and his grad students, that surgeons are probably psychopaths. So you stop and think about it. A surgeon has to be able to slice into you, having not the slightest flinch reaction. If I see you get a paper cut, I'm going to go, ooh, right? It hurts me a little bit just to see it happen to you. Mm-hmm. That's empathy. Mm-hmm. And a surgeon has to be able to do a much more elaborate cut than just a paper cut and not flinch in the slightest. They can't think of that thing in front of them on the operating table as a human being. Who could cut open a human being and have a rummage around inside? They've got to think of it as a dispassionate problem to be solved, and the great stature and great money that goes with being a surgeon means that that's the means to their end, which is the stature and the money. We just benefit from the fact that they can do a job that human beings who are normal, who have full conscience, normally can't do.
Mm-hmm. Do you lay awake at night trying to think of ways to write a book where you just make everybody feel strange?
Well, strange is an interesting term. This is an interesting book for me because, honestly, this is my 23rd novel, Quantum Night.
Uh-huh.
But honestly, I'm known as an optimistic, upbeat writer. And in fact, part of the genesis of Quantum Night was with my last couple of novels, especially a trilogy, Wake, Watch, and Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Some reviewers had been saying, he's so optimistic about the future. This is in case about, in those books, about the future of artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So optimistic, he's almost Pollyanna-ish about it, almost naively optimistic. I don't think that was a fair cop. I think my optimism is reasoned and well-grounded. But I said, okay, all right. I've done almost 2 dozen novels. Let's look at evil instead of look at the human capacity for good. Let's look at the human capacity for evil. And I started out just asking myself, is there any science of evil? Well, guess what? We have Google today. You put that question in. Is there any science of evil? And the first thing you hit is psychopathy, the study of psychopaths.
Right.
And boom, I was away to the races and writing my novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, you give us an option. I think there is, by the end of the book, you have come to us a very interesting solution to a very challenging problem that we have with this president and this world affairs. And I know that I sort of sat at the edge of my seat saying, is this going to work? And I won't say whether it does or not, because we want people to pick up this book. You will be so, if you're looking for a great read, this will open your mind in so many ways, because Rob hits on so many different things.
He does.
And you will think about faith, you will think about morality, you will think about political, and you'll think about the world in its totality, and you'll think about science for sure. And that's, I think, what was so fascinating for me. And again, like a Charles Dickens, you tie up every kind of possible loose end, things that you didn't even think were going to be important that are mentioned in the beginning part of the book somehow all tie up by the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a reader, I love that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it did tie it up to almost a perfect bow.
Almost a perfect bow. Well.
That, you know, I mean, this is the trick, of course, of writing a novel. And every novel, in some sense, is a mystery novel.
Absolutely.
Which I mean, you don't know what's a red herring, and you don't know what's important until the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The mystery novelist plays a slightly skewed game because they deliberately go to great lengths to make sure, oh, yeah, he did say that, I just forgot it, until the detective brought it in at the end, right?
Right.
But we all do that, a little bit of misdirection. Here's something, I planted, and it's going to pay off at the end.
Well, you definitely gave us some misdirection. That was for sure.
I want you to forget about it between chapter 8 and chapter 40, and then when it comes back, and you go, oh, my God, that's right, I totally forgot, slap your forehead.
There you go.
Or misdirect and make you think in chapter 8 that it meant this, and then you see it in a new light in chapter 40. That's the trick, not just me, but every novelist plays.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, give me 30 seconds. I got to do a commercial, and we'll be right back to you. This is fascinating, and, man, I'm glad you're on the show. So hang tough. We'll be right back to you. I think sometime today we're gonna do something. Here we go. Okay. You're leaving on vacation. Your tickets have been purchased. Your hotel reservations are confirmed. Mail delivery has been suspended. What about the dog? All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepovers. It's the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. All Dogs Rule provides your best four-legged friend a place to run and play outside amongst orange trees, grass, and a country setting. Your dog gets to be a dog. All Dogs Rule offer additional services including individualized playtime, personal walks, swimming, sessions in the creek, and training. Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com. How appropriate. Or give them a call at 805-524-1100. And when your pup returns home, that smile on his face will leave you wondering whose vacation was better. Well, it was the dog's, of course, because you met some jackass on the airplane that just spoiled your whole 2 weeks. Been there, done that, got that T-shirt. Okay, we're going to go back. All right, we're back with Rob. Okay. So, your other books, I like you said, they're not this dark.
That's right. This is my only dark book.
Oh, your only dark book.
And it's not.
Yeah.
And it's not. You know what? It's not really dark.
It's human life and human condition, and it's. I didn't feel that it was dark.
No.
I just felt it was enlightening. Actually.
Well, it kind of was, and it makes you want to take the test.
I know.
It's easy enough to find online. A man named Hare, like a rabbit, H-A-R-E, Hare, actually a fellow Canadian, devised a test that's used worldwide. It's called the Hare, his name, Hare, Psychopathy Checklist Revised. And it's used in jurisdictions all over the world to determine whether or not somebody is a psychopath. There's also a very good a book by John Ronson, a popular book called The Psychopath Test, which is a lot of fun about the trials and tribulations of trying to identify whether or not your boss, your neighbor, your spouse, your kid is a psychopath based on being an actor.
Do we really even really want to know that?
It's kind of like, I'm not sure.
It's like, do we really want to know that?
Well, exactly. That's right. And the thing is, of course, is as Dr. Hare, who devised the test, would be the first to say, only somebody who is highly trained can really give the test properly.
Right.
You know, you have to be an expert in what it is that you're trying to assess. Right. Just like only a highly trained meteorologist can really look at the sky and say, this cloud type over here, cirrostratus, means this, and da-da-da. You know, the rest of us is just the opening credits of The Simpsons, fluffy white clouds.
Right. Right. Yeah, but does this test give you a definitive answer, or is it just kind of
it's based
on what the tester comes up with?
In fact, in different jurisdictions, because you can get 2 points, 1 point, or 0 point on each of the 20 factors, the maximum score you can get is 40, which means that all 20 factors you have in every aspect of your life, you get a two if it's prevalent throughout your entire life. Mm-hmm. You lie to everybody. You get a one if it's only confined to part of your life. You never tell your spouse the truth, or you never tell your boss the truth, or you never tell the kids the truth. But everybody else, yeah, you kind of, you're an honest enough guy. That's a one. So the maximum score is 40, and it varies. And this is why the American Psychiatric Association has been reluctant to accept the term psychopath. One of the reasons is it varies from legal jurisdiction to legal jurisdiction.
Uh-huh.
In one state or one province or one country, a 32 might be enough, a 32 out of 40 points to make you a psychopath. Somewhere else, the standard might be 34, 36. Nobody has the standard 40. I think, you know, the pure quill psychopath is a platonic ideal of evil that I don't think ever actually existed.
Hannibal Lecter.
Adolf Hitler was kind to children, right?
Yeah.
As long as they were Aryan.
Yeah.
So, you know, and liked animals, right? So, you know, even the very definition of evil incarnate would not hit 40 out of 40.
If you hit a 40, does that mean you get the hockey mask and put on the hand truck and get wheeled around?
Well, see, I would bet, looking at Hannibal Lecter,
right,
there were a few, who's who you're referring to, of course, the Silence of the Lambs from the Thomas Harris novel and the film starring Anthony Hopkins. He had a little bit of compassion there, as much as he liked playing with Clarice Starling.
Right. Well, he liked her.
Jodie Foster character. There was some, you could clearly see, and especially if you've read the sequels that Thomas Harris wrote, you could clearly see that there was some affection there.
Right.
Some respect for Clarice as a real human being, which a 40 out of 40 psychopath would not have.
Right. Yeah. Right. Clarice.
Yeah. Can I ask a process?
Chianti.
may I switch gears a little bit and ask you a writing process question?
Of course.
For this particular book, for instance, was there a lot you edited out? And if so, what did you edit out?
There wasn't really. You know, earlier in my career, this book's 100,000 words, which is a fairly typical novel these days. Early in my career, my books used to weigh in first draft at 125, 130, and I'd have to pare them back. But as you go along in your career, you sort of see the blind alleys very soon after you've started down them, rather than writing whole chapters that you're going to cut. But there was one chapter that my editors felt should go, and I keep meaning to put it up on my website, actually, that didn't involve any of the main characters, but was showing some of these beings without conscience, the mob, under the thrall of a psychopath chasing down and killing, sadly, an undocumented
during the riots.
In southern
U.S. During the riots.
But this was separate from the riots. This was a separate scene that led to one of the court case events.
Gotcha.
And I thought, and ultimately they thought it was too gruesome. A little bit hard to follow when you read it the first time. Of course, in retrospect, once you understood the whole scheme of the three levels of psychopathy, that I postulated in the novel, it made sense in retrospect. But they were probably right that it should go. Mm-hmm. But it's always a pain. You know, you spend on a chapter, is a couple of days, if not a week, solid work to get right. Mm-hmm. And then after you've done that, when somebody says, you know what, throw it out. It'd be like somebody saying to you, you do the writer's block once a week. Somebody said to you at the end of today's show, you know what, let's not air that one. I know we're live here, but if it was a tape show, just throw that one out. That's a week of your life, right?
Right.
That's gone.
Mm-hmm.
A week.
Yeah, it's a book I just read for nothing.
Right?
Right, right.
And so
right.
You try to avoid that as much as possible.
Sure.
But in this particular case, there wasn't a lot that got trimmed out.
Mm-hmm.
Do you work on more than one? You're a prolific writer. Do you work on more than one project at a time, or do you start with one and see it through
to
completion?
More than one project, but not more than one book.
Okay.
I find I can't keep two novels straight in my mind.
Uh-huh.
But I can work on a screenplay or a teleplay, that's a script for television,
right.
And a novel, excuse me, and shift back and forth. They're very different processes. Obviously, a screenplay is very structured, has a very rigid format.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they're very different conceptually. A novel is about the inner life of a single viewpoint character in each scene, what that person is thinking and feeling and experiencing. And a screenplay is about watching a ping pong match. You are always a spectator in a screenplay, and the camera work will ultimately be cutting back and forth between
right.
person A, person B, long shot that shows A and B, close-up of B, close-up of A. You're not any one of those characters. You're a spectator, and you never hear what they're thinking inside. You only hear their dialogue or
right.
see what they do with their body language. So I can keep, because the projects are different at that fundamental DNA level, I can keep them separate and work on one of each at the same time. But two novels or two screenplays, I can't do at the same time.
Well, and I see that you're also a much highly regarded keynote speaker, so you obviously are very comfortable on your feet with an audience.
Thank you. Yes, and my most recent one was in Puebla, Mexico. I was just there, 10 days ago now. Giving a keynote at a conference where Noam Chomsky was speaking, Steven Pinker, the great Harvard linguist, was speaking. Spinking. That's what Pinker does. Speaking. It was just wonderful. It was wonderful. I've been traveling all over the world. Just got back from China. I've given talks in Spain and Switzerland. I'm off to India next year, all over the world, giving talks about the way science and technology is going to impact our future. As a science fiction writer, I've obviously given an awful lot of thought to the future of automation, artificial intelligence, biotechnology, life prolongation, all of these issues. And I'm lucky enough that many government conferences or industry conferences will invite me to share my thoughts on those issues. So I love, love, love doing it.
Oh, good.
Well, and that must be a way that you're able to keep on top of, you know, so many of our authors are maybe writing about historical fiction, and they're going back and doing research on prior times, and you're really writing contemporarily, and you have to stay on top of cutting-edge technology and even what maybe some of us aren't even aware of, but
right.
you are. And that was my other question, is sort of how do you find the time to keep abreast of all of
right.
that?
Right.
Well, I'm lucky enough to be a full-time writer. And that said, about a third of my time, to be 4 months out of a year, is spent on nothing but research, often of a very general variety, just so I'm keeping up to date. Not just on science, by the way, but on public policy and on the issues, you know, that our governments are having to grapple with. A classic example right now, I've been writing about artificial intelligence forever. We now have self-driving cars, but there's a whole issue of the ethics of self-driving cars.
Yeah.
If a little kid runs out in front of a self-driving car,
who's responsible?
Does the car run over the kid and therefore not hurt the driver, the passenger, or swerve and hit a brick wall, killing the passenger but saving the little kid?
Sure.
That's a big philosophical issue.
Sure.
And I'm fascinated by how different governments are grappling with those issues right now. And so I keep abreast on public policy. I read an awful lot of history as well as a lot of science. attend scientific conferences, meet with scientists on a regular basis, and just have lots of friends who are working scientists and also work in various levels of government, policymakers, who I also pick their brains constantly.
I'm tired just listening to you.
Oh, I'm invigorated. This is another author that I want to read, all of his books.
Hey, we're going to be running out of time here pretty quick, Rob. So let me ask you the question. Have you ever had writer's block?
So I don't actually believe in writer's block.
Yeah, you're one of many.
When writer's block occurs, what really has happened is that you've written to a point where you don't know what happens next. So you've got your character dangling off a cliff, to use the classic cliffhanger example.
Sure.
And you don't know how he's going to be rescued. Is it a helicopter? Is it he has a secret parachute we don't know about? Is somebody going to show up with a ladder? You have no idea how to get him out of that situation. You're stymied. You can't move ahead. But you do know that this isn't the end of the book, his rescue. You know that down the road, he's going to have a confrontation with his girlfriend or with his boss or with, somebody or something else. Jump ahead and write that. The problem with us writers is that we are such good at spinning fables and fibs on the page. We've managed to convince the whole world of this lie, which is we're allowed to say, can't work today. Got writer's block. No policeman gets to say, you know how it is, cop block, right?
I have never heard it put this way.
That's great.
Right?
And never.
No other profession. Yeah, but it's true. No other profession gets away with that. And
we
are so
sick.
Good we even convinced ourselves that we were allowed to take a day off work because, the juices aren't flowing, the muse isn't there. I'll get to it tomorrow. Well, that's no way to make a living as a writer. And I've been lucky enough to make a living as a writer for 30 years now.
Most of us writers, we never give up our day jobs.
Well, that's the sad truth, of course, is that most writers don't get to give up their day jobs. I fully acknowledge a huge dollop of luck has come my way. Yes, I work hard. Yes, I've got some talent. But there are people who work as hard as I do and are as talented or more talented than I am who haven't had a few of the secular blessings that have come my way. I'm always grateful for that.
Go ahead.
Have your books been independently published, or you've been working with different publishing houses?
I've worked with four of the big five.
Yeah.
So HarperCollins, Hachette, Macmillan, and Penguin Random House.
Yeah.
And some of my backlist, my older titles, which had fallen out of print, are now back in print, available as my own independently published editions, eight of them now, and more to come. And I'm enjoying that experience immensely, I have to say. Although I've been, I would say 9 times out of 10, I've loved the covers that my publishers have given me.
Mm-hmm.
10 times out of 10, when you're a self-publisher, you love your cover. You love your cover blurbs. You love, you're in control. It's of every aspect, and that's very gratifying to
it
have
is.
That degree of control.
It is.
So what did you do with your first advance?
Well, it wasn't that big. It was way a long time ago, my first novel, 1990, $3,500 U.S. And so I said to myself, and I had a good career as a nonfiction writer prior to that, magazine and journalism and corporate and government writing of newsletters, brochures, speeches, things like that. So I said, I'm going to blow the whole thing promoting this book.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to go to conferences. I'm going to buy copies of the book just to give away to people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do everything I can. I thought, $3,500. I mean, it was 1990, so it was a little more significant than $3,500 today. But it was not life-changing. It wasn't like I could buy a house or a car or travel around the world
right.
So I thought, put 100% of it in launching that career.
Back into
cycle
business.
It back into the business the way, a restaurateur would in the first year of his business. He's not making a profit. He's doing everything to build a clientele.
Right.
I thought, take a business approach to it and cycle the money back into the business. And it did pay off.
You know what? It's been fascinating. I have to let you go. Robert, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm really looking forward to joining the stable with Mickey, and it's going to be fun.
My pleasure, Jim, Bobby. It's been an absolute blast.
If you would, before you go, let our listeners know your email address and where they can find you on your regular website. And a fabulous website, by the way. And Facebook and Twitter and whatever else you got going.
All of the social media is just my name, all run together, no punctuation, Robert J. Sawyer, okay. S-A-W-Y-E-R, like Tom. And in terms of my website, either robertjsawyer.com or SF, as in science fiction, sfwriter.com will take you there, sfwriter.com.
Okay. And that's, thank you so much for joining us.
A blast.
It's been a hoot. It's been a hoot. And come back and see us. Get a hold of the bookie and come back in.
There must be something published
next year sometime.
Soon. Yeah, you must have something in the works.
Maybe next time I'm in Los Angeles.
We love it. You can always come in and sit in the studio and talk to whoever we got on the air.
That'd be terrific.
Thanks a lot again, Robert.
Thank you, Rob.
My pleasure.
Take care. Have a pleasant evening. Oh, you were going to make sure you send me that address in San Francisco so I can get you a mug.
Yes. So I'll do that. Yes.
Okay. Absolutely. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Robert J. Sawyer. Wow, what a guy.
Still got to know if I'm a Q1, 2, or 3.
I know.
I think I'm probably a Q1.
I'm going to have to find the test now. You know what? Next week, we have a friend of Richard Polinelli's coming in. Her name is Marina Fontaine.
And I am reading that book now.
She has written two books, one called Chasing Freedom.
That's the one I'm reading.
And the other is The Product. And she'll be with us next Thursday. And of course, after tonight, Bobby only has two more shows with us in studio.
This is true.
And we're losing her to Albuquerque.
Yes, moving to Albuquerque.
Well, at least you'll be right in the center between us
and
Gary. So
absolutely. Well, and I will still be a part of the Writer's Block.
Of course you will, because you were a founding person of the Writer's Block.
I love this show and love being a part of this show.
We love having you, and we're going to miss you terribly. Because it's always so much fun sitting here looking across the desk at you.
We'll have to figure out how to do that with the computer.
Knowing you're going to cover my faux pas. That's what I love. So at any rate, that's it for tonight. Thank you so much for joining us on yet another rendition of the Writer's Block. And next week, of course, is again Marina Fontaine, Chasing Freedom and The Product. And Robert J. Sawyer's book, of course, is Quantum Night. You can find it on Amazon.
It's great.
On his website. Any of the online booksellers, get it. If you're a science fiction fan, get it.
Wrap it up for Christmas. Yep.
Okay, that's do it for us. And we are out of here for just another Thursday. We'll be back here at 7 o'clock next Thursday night right here on LA Talk Radio.